thank you. It's good to see everybody again. This is actually a tag team, so I'm going to be speaking on sort of just some principles on sustainable programs, medical missions, and international medical missions. And then from Rosalind Franklin, Rachel's going to be speaking on their component and the actual data that we implemented in our program in Haiti and Port-au-Prince through Step-by-Step Haiti and Rosalind Franklin teaming together at Bernard Meves Hospital. So mine's more about principles. Rachel's going to be talking more about the hard data. So no disclosures. When I've done a lot of medical mission work over the years, and I found this article in JBJS in 2015, and it looked at the sustainability of short-term international medical missions, and you know, do we really make an impact or not? Is it something that's beneficial? And is it beneficial on both avenues, coming both directions? So this paper looked at Operation Walk Boston, which is a yearly medical mission trip to the Dominican Republic, and they did total knees and total hips since 2008. And they've documented positive patient outcomes and high-quality care in the program through two separate published articles in 2011 and 2013. But they wanted to look at, in this research, the sustainability. And it's about the principles, and that's kind of what I want to talk about today, too, the principles of something like this. So what they did is they interviewed 21 American Dominican participants, and the specific goals were to look at, okay, what happens at the Dominican side and what happens back at the U.S. side from doing some sort of program like this. And you can see the breakdown of people that they interviewed in this article on both sides. So the first thing they looked at is, okay, what changes occurred at the Dominican side by Operation Walk Boston going there? And the first thing they talked about was the knowledge transfer. And I think that's the most important thing with any kind of medical mission is transfer of knowledge. I can go and do 20 or 30 surgeries in a week. I used to do that in Honduras, and we would take over the whole hospital, and all the Honduran physicians would leave the hospital. And that had a very limited effect. But in Haiti, and now whenever I go anywhere, I do not go anywhere where I'm not working side by side with the local physicians trying to transfer knowledge, and that's really what's important. So all participants in the study attributed changes to the Dominican hospital to knowledge and skills shared by Operation Walk Boston. So this is a quote from the Dominican surgeon. Interacting, discussing difficult cases which we don't have the ability to resolve, we learned how to resolve some of them from these professors. So, you know, it's the old thing, you can either give a man a fish or teach him how to fish, and that's what we're trying to do. The growth of the hospital, orthopedic services in the Dominican hospital went from 20 joint replacements in 2008 to 110 in 2013. So you can see that the numbers were improving just by this knowledge transfer. The other thing they looked at was patient safety and quality improvement. And were they sort of imparting best practice techniques in the Dominican hospital? And they were. And these are some of the things that they tried to stress to the Dominican side. Things like the World Health Surgical Safety Checklist, documentation, things like that. That's one of the things that we've struggled with in Haiti in our diabetic foot program, is just getting wound measurements and locations and type of wounds. And getting that documentation so then we can start to analyze the data, and that's what some of Rachel's going to talk about. So they looked at the nursing professional development and empowerment, talking more about the team structure, and that's a big deal in developing countries. Nurses are very down on the totem pole, unfortunately, and they have a hard time being taken seriously by physicians, and that's something that you have to kind of work through and try to change that paradigm in a developing country in the facility that you're working in. And you're giving the nurses a sense of an empowerment by sort of reinforcing their status in the healthcare hierarchy. And then looking at a catalyst for change, the participants provided insight into factors that enabled the knowledge transfer to spread to other departments. So just because you're just doing orthopedics or diabetic foot, those practice protocols or those protocols of safety checklists for surgery go throughout the whole surgical department. So you're affecting the whole hospital, the whole system, not just within that department. Another was research, and that's one of the things that we've been doing with our team concept here, and they're understanding the importance of research and how we can use that data to keep this program sustainable long-term by analyzing the data that we're gathering. And then the dissemination of expertise occurred through the nurses working within different departments also. So what are some of the barriers to knowledge transfer, opportunities for programmatic improvement, and this was lack of Spanish-speaking American volunteers. In Haiti, it's Creole. I've been to Haiti probably almost 20 times now, and I still can only speak about 5 or 6 words of Creole. I wish I could learn Creole, but I need to sit down and try to learn it. But it would make things much easier. And one of the problems you run into is most physicians in developing countries, no matter where you go, speak English. So you can communicate with the physicians, but it's the rest of the personnel within the hospital that do not speak English, so you run into barriers there. Again, that hierarchical structure within the hospital, trying to break that down. And then the importance of showing the local staff's practice styles and learning preferences. And this is a really important concept. It's almost very egotistical when we come there and try to teach them what we think they should know. We need to teach them what they would like to know, what they want. So this is a quote from a nurse. The first year we were teaching them about hand washing, infection control, very basic things that they knew quite well. The following year we sought their advice and asked them what they wanted to learn. So I'm going back to Haiti in December to work with the surgeons. And my goal is to try to improve the functional surgical outcomes and functional amputations. But I need to know what they need to know. I mean, I have an idea from being down there and seeing what they're doing, but we need to have a conversation before I go so I can prepare, you know, what do you guys need to know from a surgeon standpoint on how to deal with a diabetic foot. So then the other part was, okay, what kind of effect did this study have, or this mission trip have back on the U.S. practice? So changes, they saw increased cultural exposure, allows both groups to understand each other. I've been to Haiti so often, some of my best friends are Haitians, and I understand the country very well. I could probably go down there and live and get by okay. I've been down there enough. So it's important for Americans to get acquainted with the Dominican staff's working abilities in order to better divide assignments. This is a quote from a U.S. nurse. We've learned, too, we are more sensitive. I think that at the beginning there was just so much work to do, we just needed to get it done, so they got pushed to the side. Now we really are collaborative. It's really easy to go into a place like Haiti or Honduras and just take over. That does very little good. You've got to work side by side, and you've got to let them do it. You've got to have them. I mean, I can debride the ulcers in our wound care clinic if the staff isn't debriding them correctly, but it's a much more impactful thing if I say, no, grab a curette, stop holding the tin blade with your fingers, grab a curette and actually debride it and show them how deep they need to get. So participants highlight pain management. This is a big thing. I've done a lot of surgery in Haiti, and the amount of pain medicine we use here compared to like a developing country is unbelievable. They need very little. So understanding that local cultural difference between the two countries. So this is from a physical therapist. For me, it's respecting somebody else's culture and their beliefs and their way of doing things. And then barriers to change. The Dominican staff speculated that we rely so much on protocols, we become very unflexible. When you're working in a developing country, you have to be flexible. You have to be adaptive. You have to not be so rigid. You've got to be able to kind of go with the flow. And then also, we can learn from them. It's not a one-way learning opportunity. Last, I think, two times ago when I was in Haiti, there was a virus called chikungunya going through, which is a viral infection that's mosquito-based. And it just kind of had hit the country. I never heard of it. So they were teaching me about that, you know, so stuff like that. Other things, just that working in with teams, the team approach, and then also greater appreciation of teamwork. This is a physician talking about how in the U.S., sometimes the healthcare provider roles can become adversarial. I do not ever get any kind of, oh, you're a podiatrist type comment when I'm working in a developing country at all. I mean, they respect what we do. We respect what they do. We're a team. And then also you become a lot more cost conscious. Everything comes at a price, and everything is hard to get the money to purchase that. So that's an ongoing thing, is being cost aware of what everything is that we're using. This is the conclusion of their study. Just a couple of things here. You know, you want to establish a long-term trusting relationship. I think that's important, creating lasting changes. And then you want to incorporate their cultural norms and organizational structure into your plan. And then I also like how they say, you need to assess the extent of what you're influencing the practice and culture of the international partner. So those are some, that was a conclusion from their paper. I thought it was a really good paper. It sort of reinforced the international medical mission thing. And we're talking about establishing a diabetic foot program in a developing country. I really think there are four legs to it, and I working really hard to get this set up in Haiti. It's the preventative care, so it's a diabetic routine foot care, exams or risk classification, and appropriate shoe gear with accommodative orthoses. In Haiti, for example, diabetic shoes are not an option. They're just too expensive. But we can wear tennis shoes. We can wear a gym shoe. And I'm trying to find a good resource to make a good accommodative orthotic, for example. So, and once somebody has a wound, how to debride it properly, the right kind of dressing, compression therapy, and then offloading. And when somebody needs surgery, preventative care surgery, we're talking about a lot about functional amputations. In Haiti, for example, we have no vascular reconstruction. So that's a limiting factor. So I don't have a vascular surgeon that I can get somebody revascularized to try to save their toe. I have to figure out how much of the foot I can save and try to keep it as functional as possible, and that's one of the things I'm trying to teach. And then tendon balancing. And then when somebody does have a wound that's healed or surgery that they've healed from, preventing recurrence and then appropriate shoe gear with accommodative orthoses again, and again, diabetic routine foot care and then prosthesis as needed. So now I'm going to have Rachel discuss the actual...
All righty. So my name is Rochelle. I am a second year student at Scholl College, and I was lucky enough to jump onto this research this summer for my summer research. Initially, the entire project was funded between DePaul and RFUMS. They combined together. DePaul was a big part of our IT and the infrastructure and setting up the internet down in Haiti. Me personally, I was funded through NIH grant through our CLEAR program at Scholl to join on and do some research and see if this telehealth is actually doing something. So what is telehealth? I feel like the word gets thrown around a lot, and there's a lot of different definitions. This is kind of one I've made up on my own. The use of communication and education through long-distance learning to promote an advancement in knowledge and an improvement in healthcare outcomes. So it's not solely improving these healthcare outcomes, but also educating the staff and the physicians that you're communicating with. Currently, we're using WebEx as our form of telehealth. I think it's incredible. There's a lot of different options, so we always shoot to use video, but sometimes you're not going to get the bandwidth down there, or you're not going to get the full video screen, so it's nice that you can also have audio, or if someone is not at a computer, they can use their phone and call in, and they can also be on the conference call with us, as well as typing in. So say you're in a meeting, probably shouldn't be on it, but you can also join in and see what's going on and to type in any of your comments. So the specific aims of the study initially were to measure the rate of lower extremity amputations before and after our interventions of this telemedicine. We were also looking at wound size for diabetic foot ulcers. This is what I was specifically looking at for my research this summer. We really hoped that this telemedicine would be helping to lower the amputation rates. As well as looking at the barriers that are addressed with a different country. So can we reach the same rates that we normally would in the U.S.? Internationally right now, the rate is 4 months for diabetic foot ulcers, with expected healing rate. Is that a realistic number to be putting on this Haitian staff? Should we be looking at different numbers, or should we be looking at just in general improvements? So the population was split into two different ones. Cohort one was all of this patients that were in the study for the year before we started this. We implemented in April. We went down for 3 days, and they set up a little knowledge-based teaching of basic foot ulcer treatments and what you should be doing or what you can be doing with the resources that they have there. So we did that for 3 days and came back and started these telehealth sessions. So cohort two was all the patients that have been seen starting after we did our initial telehealth session. So we ended up with 44 in the first cohort, and we have 32 currently in the second cohort. This is the team right now. On the left, that's Dr. Adler Francis. He is the head surgeon, and he is in charge of this wound care clinic. All of these lovely ladies are our nurses that are working hard there day in and day out to make this happen. In the bottom right, you can see the TV screen. So that is the TV that they have set up for their telehealth conferences with us. We got to go down there and see it from their end, which I thought was a really nice aspect to see what's going on from their end to see connecting to the U.S. Day to day in this clinic, they see anywhere from 40 to 70 wounds in a morning. They're seeing a lot of volume. It's a lot bigger than what you would see here in a normal morning. Everything's different. As he was saying, you're going to be debriding a wound with just the top of a scalpel. You're not going to have a handle blade. So there's a lot of different barriers that we got to see when we went down there. Also, we noticed there was a lot more dorsal wounds, we think probably from trauma. But specifically in the research, we were looking at the diabetic foot ulcer. So on that left-hand side was one of our participants. So creating a wound care telehealth program. We were doing bi-monthly telehealth conferences. We would hope to do it every week, but it's a little too much. It's hard to get them over there with the internet, get our busy schedules here as well. bimonthly was the best that we could do. I think that we were doing a lot of the staff education and the physician education in the beginning in hopes to have it to be more case-by-case consultations as they went on. But even though that's the goal, it doesn't always happen that way. I think that charting, the art of charting, was something that they really struggled with. So though we wanted to look at case-by-case consultations and really help them with decision-making and so forth, we really had to express the understanding of how important it is to chart and how you cannot assess ulcers if you don't know what the size was initially and how much it's progressed. And the idea of looking at your outliers and saying, okay, we're not healing them in a rate that we want to, what should we do to change it? I think a big thing for them was pride, and they started presenting us a lot of cases that were good cases, which was nice, and they were proud of them, but we weren't helping them in that sense. We had to really say, you know what, we have cases too, so I ended up presenting a case that we weren't healing to show them that we have cases here as well, and we're not healing, and we have to stop and think about it with all of our staff and decide what to do. And just overall, we were looking to decrease that area size. So, are we making a difference? So, chart completion was something that I spent a lot of time down there reading all of those lovely Creole charts and learning the French and the Creole. Most of the physicians, as he was saying, spoke English, but they would write in their charts in French. But then none of the nurses knew French, so they would be writing in Creole. So to go through them all took a long time, and to explain the importance of it. We were very happy to see that 4 out of the 5 measures of the chart documentation improved after we started the program. So that was, I was very excited about that. And also, we think that it could be even more than that. A lot of charts were thrown out, a lot of patients were thrown out because there was no charting to look at to see if they were making improvements before we started the telehealth sessions. As you can see here, these are the p-values. So those were the, in the middle of the chart, are the things that we were looking at for charting. So initial visits with ulcer measurements. So the first day they come in, making sure we're looking at those ulcer measurements and writing them down. Total visits with ulcer measurements, the importance of doing it every time, not just, well, I did it 3 weeks ago, I did it 2 weeks ago, it looks a little better. Location on the foot. And then we also started ABIs and A1Cs. I think a difficult thing with our A1Cs are the only thing that were not significant, and I think a big thing is to do the A1C down there, they have to be at a certain temperature, and a lot of times you are unable to get an A1C because they were too hot, so it might not be that they're not trying, but it's not something that they can put in the chart because we were unable to get it. So for the barriers, after every single one of our sessions, we would have the nurses and all of the staff there fill out a survey and express what they felt were the barriers we thought was very important. As you can see here, language was obviously the biggest thing. We would have one translator, but it's also going through this virtual system, whether or not they're picking up everything that you're saying, and whether or not they're saying what we are telling them to say, we don't know. We're not sure if that's what's getting addressed. So language was a big barrier, and they saw that on their side as well. And the next biggest deal would be probably the technical difficulties. Is the internet always running? Is it not? Did it take another hour to get this started, et cetera? So are we making an impact? Here we have our Kaplan-Meier plot. The top line is the blue line, so that's cohort 1 for the first year before we started our study, and cohort 2 would be the red line, and this is the probability of remaining unhealed after a year. So obviously 4 months wasn't a good predictor if they still had people remaining unhealed within a year of that first one, but we can see within we've been doing it for 90 days at the point when I made this, that they are making a significantly decrease in the amount of wounds that are still open within 90 days. So progression and growth. We're really looking to expand this. I think that we've had great results so far in such a short amount of time, and hopefully it would continue. We would look on to join some new hospitals. As of right now, Hospital Bernard Medicine's clinic we're working with is the only wound clinic in the entire nation. So they do not have anybody else that's specific for wounds. They have, you could go to the hospital and get your wound treated, etc. We're hoping to get one of the other hospitals on to join and hopefully set up a wound care program with them as well. It would be really great to get them to use this telehealth between them, I think, rather than solely with us, and to really teach them, as I said, the communication and the power of knowledge to spread that wealth between them. After the hurricane, I think that they lost a lot of great physicians as well as healthcare centers, so to be able to communicate with who is still there would be great. And just the passion of our partners, I think that everyone down there is so passionate about really making this happen and seeing their progress, they get more excited about continuing it. And everyone in the U.S. as well is really passionate about making this happen. As of right now, we did not get funded for our second grant cycle, so we really hope to, and we'll start looking for some extramural funding, and hopefully we can continue this. Any questions? None?
Did you have any dissemination from the nurses to the patients, or was it just nurses? patients, not, you know, being in a clinical encounter the entire time they're, you know, living at home.
Mm-hmm.
So you need dissemination of knowledge as far as how to take
Well, there's one of the partners we work with is there's an educational-based program called Body Mock, and they do a really good job about educating patients on the diabetes and then the preventative care part, but they also, as far as that preventative care part, talk about diabetic foot care education.
Okay.
So they do that there, and then within the clinic too, they, you know, compliance is an issue even here, right, with diabetic patients, but it's an issue there too, as far as, you know, following, you know, offloading strategies and things like that. But yes, the nurses do relate that to the